Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Chuck Klosterman, who reads from and discusses his new book, Downtown Owl, published by Scribner. In the weeks to come, we have Jules Pfeiffer, Gustavo Arellano, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a moment. It's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. So I have more of a story than an introduction for you tonight. Back in what I believe was 2001, I could be off a year by that, I was living with this guy who was a musician, and I was always coming home with book galleys. Book galleys are advanced reading copies of books that aren't out in the store yet. And he wasn't much of a reader, but I brought this book home, and he completely devoured it. And the book got passed around from bandmate to bandmate to bandmate, and they all just kind of went a little gaga. And the band, what I'd like to say, the band was never the same again. And the best part is that I swear we almost broke up over this book. And at the time, the book was a little unknown thing, and you've all heard of it by now, called Fargo Rock City. So, it is now with my complete delight, many years later, to introduce you to you tonight, the author of Fargo Rock City, here with his new book, Downtown Owl. So please join me in welcoming Chuck Klosterman.
Hello. Thanks for the intro. She actually left out the most interesting part of that story. The band is actually U2. She was living with The Edge, and then that sort of... Yeah, I know. Bob Dylan told me not to do that. See, you didn't get... Okay. Well, hey, thanks for coming out. I've never actually read in Denver before. I read in Boulder, I guess, a couple years ago. And I suppose, because of the football game tonight, I would guess that would affect sort of the crowd. I'm sure there's... I mean, if I was... somebody else who was like me who lived here, I'd probably be watching it, so I probably wouldn't be here either. So I really appreciate you coming out. So it's interesting whenever you do a book reading, the bookstore people, they're always very nervous that the author will be upset if, like, there's not, like, you know, a big crowd, especially when you start, like, when I did that Fargo Rock City tour. Like, sometimes I would go to, I remember I went to Chicago, and the guy was really excited. He set up 150 chairs, and three people came. And it turned out I knew two of them. Yeah. And they always feel bad. So the way they always try to compensate is they always try to tell you, they always use the weather sort of as the determining factor. So if it rains, they'll be like, well, you know, it's raining. People aren't going to come out in the rain. You know, it's too bad it rained, you know. But if it's really nice, they'll be like, the last nice day of summer. You know, people did not want to come to a book reading. It's this last chance for it to be nice. You know, be really windy. They'll be like, well, there's a lot of kite enthusiasts in this town. And this might be the last opportunity to, you know, get the box kite in the air. But anyways, thanks a lot for coming. It's great being here. I'm going to read from this novel I'd written. I had written basically four nonfiction books. And now I've come up with a work of fiction, and it's always sort of difficult to pick a section from a novel to read because, well, for one, I mean, obviously, I'm sort of assuming these books are going to be read silently, you know? Like, you don't really imagine people reading them loud, especially me being the one who wrote it. But also, because it's, you know, it's not a collection. And when I did essays, it was really easy. I would just pick one essay, read an essay. It'd kind of be a self-contained little organism. But this, obviously, is like 200 and some pages, and you kind of need to read all of it to figure it out. And there's three characters, and by reading one character, it's going to make you guys think the whole book is about this. And so I'm very torn over this. But got to do it, right? It's a book reading. So what I'll do is I'll kind of explain what this book is about. I'll do this read from this section, and then I'll take questions about anything. If you want to ask about this book or about the other books or about media in general or music or sports or whatever, you know. No questions about bears. Maybe one. You can ask one question about bears. Anything beyond that is fine. See, you thought that was funny, but you don't know why. If you got in my mind and came out, you'd know it's hilarious. But this book is set in a small town in North Dakota, a fictional town. Now, perhaps coincidentally, I'm from North Dakota, from a small town in North Dakota, so people might think this is my life, but that's not really what it is. It's sort of a composite a lot of my town and a lot of towns that I remember, especially from like my friends at college talking about. One of my friends is from Candu, North Dakota. He's in the audience tonight. He'll probably be able to shed light on this story. If you have, so if you want to ask a question to him later, that would be fine. It's set in 1983, and there's basically two incidents that sort of are the tent poles for this narrative. There was a kind of a cataclysmic blizzard in February of 1984 that I really remembered. And I wanted to sort of write about that incident. And something that kind of predates the action in this story was in 1983, a guy named Gordon Call was a tax evader. This was sort of when tax evasion was popular. And some federal marshals from Fargo came out to demand that he pay the $10,000 he owned, and he shot a couple of them. And then he was kind of in this national manhunt, and he was eventually kind of killed by the killed by the FBI in Arkansas. They burned him alive in a house. But I really, really vividly remember that story, mostly because I think it was the first time I'd ever heard North Dakota in the news for non-meteorological reasons. You know, so those are kind of the two things I started with, and then in between these events, I kind of talk about the lives of these three characters. One is a 23-year-old woman from Wisconsin who moved to this small town. And if any of you are from, I'm guessing this is true everywhere, if you're from a really small community, especially if it's rural, a lot of new women don't appear there, but a lot of guys from that town tend to stay there. So anytime a new woman comes in who's always a school teacher, she's kind of simultaneously pursued by 40 guys at once, you know. So that's sort of her story, kind of talking about that experience. That experience actually happened to my sister-in-law. And my brother married her, so I guess he won. The character's not based on my sister, but that experience, sister-in-law, but that experience sort of is. Another character is a 73-year-old guy who's lived in this town his whole life. So there's kind of all this sort of mythology about the town, kind of rural myths, and he's able to sort of talk, just kind of look back on his life and kind of talk about what's real and what isn't. His wife dies from kind of a strange illness where she basically can't fall asleep, which is a real illness, and I was told by some of my friends in the medical profession it would be the single worst way to die, so I threw that in there. And then there's a third character who's a junior in high school named Mitch. And he's just kind of, I think a lot of teenagers, this Mitch character is just sort of abstractly depressed. There's no specific thing that makes him unhappy. If you asked him if he was depressed, he would probably say no. But he just sort of lives in this kind of dark world where nothing kind of is interesting. And I think a lot of teenagers are like that. And one of his main issues in his life is sort of the problems he has with his football coach, who's also his English teacher, who seems kind of, an enemy of his. But he also is kind of baffling because this high school football coach keeps getting high school girls pregnant, and no one seems to care. Or they care, but they don't do anything about it, and this is really maddening to him. Particularly that the coach has recently got a girl named Tina McAndrew pregnant, who was a very attractive girl in the school. This teacher also is an issue for him because he has nicknamed him, the character's name is Mitch Herlicka, which is kind of a semi-common name where I'm from, and it's spelled H-R-L-I-C-K-A. So the teacher always calls him Vanna because he feels like he should buy a vowel for his name. So I guess maybe Wheel of Fortune is not popular, but so those I'm telling you this because you just might make this little passage more clear. So this is takes place on essentially the first day of school of this kid's junior year, and the first class of the day is English class, and I'll just kind of read this section, and then we'll go on from there. Take a sip of water. Sorry. Also, I had a small problem today. My belt broke. Has anybody had this happen? A belt breaks? You know? So now I got to wear this belt. It's the only belt I could find. So I'm like, it's basically this close to being a rope. Like I'm almost Ellie Mae Clampett at this point. So if I seem distracted, or if the book is boring, it could be because of the belt. Don't overlook the element of the belt. Okay. August 29th, 1983, Mitch. John S. Laidlaw was a football coach, a pheasant hunter, a two-pack-a-day smoker, a notorious cheapskate, a deeply closeted atheist, and an outspoken libertarian. But he was also an English teacher, and were it not for his preoccupation with convincing female students to have intercourse with him inside his powder blue Caprice Classic, he might have been among the best educators in the entire state of North Dakota. He was certainly the finest teacher in Owl, even when you factor in the emotional cruelty and the statutory raping. Good morning. Good morning. I hope everyone who's supposed to be in this room is in this room. Laidlaw spoke to his class while standing behind nothing. He rarely sat at his desk and never used a podium. He spoke with enthusiasm, but he made no hand gestures. His eyes bulged like a Komodo dragon's. John Laidlaw was not handsome, but he was Steve Martin sexy. Hey, somebody here likes Steve Martin, yeah. This is him speaking again. At this juncture, I would normally welcome all of you to Junior English. However, I'm abundantly aware that none of you would be here if this class wasn't required by the state of North Dakota, so I'm not going to talk to you like cocktail guests. There will be no pretending in this classroom. I am not a showman. I am not a jester or a salesman. This is the situation. The situation is this. For the next 9 months, you are my indentured servants. Ho, ho, ho. Much of the class, and certainly all of the girls, laughed at this remark, which is what they were expected to do. Mitch, however, did not chuckle. Mitch fantasized about tying Mr. Laidlaw to a bed and cutting long incisions into his torso with a razor blade before filling the wounds with Morton salt. He closed his eyes and imagined this while Laidlaw spoke. Now, as many as you know, Junior English is normally when we study American literature, which means we read literature from American literary figures. These are people like Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. These are people like Richard Wright, who was black. These are poets like Robert Frost, who wrote about activities such as chopping wood and walking through a forest after a snowstorm, as these things are often symbolic of disenchantment. Herman Melville was an American author, and he wrote Moby Dick, which is the greatest book of all time. Has anyone here read Moby Dick? There were 22 juniors in the room. 21 of them had never even seen the cover of Moby Dick, so they remained silent out of necessity. The 22nd junior, Rebecca Gruba, had read Moby Dick in sixth grade. She remained silent by choice, just as she had and just as she would, for the duration of every class she ever took or would take during her 13 years inside the rectangular classroom of Owl Public School. During that 13-year span, Rebecca Gruba would never score less than 94 on any scholastic examination, except for 167 on an extra-credit trigonometry test that no one else was able to attempt. Rebecca Gruba taught herself how to read when she was four. She won the state spelling bee in 1976, 1977, and 1979. She had mono in the spring of 78. She understood how isotopes operated before she knew what isotopes were. She could count cards and memorize Social Security numbers. As an eighth grader, she read Finnegan's Wake over Christmas Vacation and scrawled the digits 1132 on her Earth Science notebook. Oh, somebody loves that book, huh? No one asked why she did this. Rebecca Gruba was a genius. Everybody in Owl knew it, but hardly anyone cared. She was so shy that she wasn't even unpopular. Over time, her wordless brilliance became routine, and then it became boring. People quit noticing. In 1988, Rebecca Gruba would become a registered nurse. "No one here has read Moby Dick," Laidlaw continued after a pause. "Not one person. Not even you, Rebecca?" Rebecca did not respond. "Jeepers cripes, not one person in this room has perused the 752 brilliant pages of Moby Dick. That's stunning. That's really, really stunning. Also, this is sarcasm. Do we all know what sarcasm is? Sarcasm is when you tell someone the truth by lying on purpose. Does anyone in this room even know what Moby Dick is about?" "It's about a guy who kills a whale," said Eli Zebra. "It's about a guy who kills a sperm whale with a harpoon." Zebra answered a lot of questions during class, especially if they were not important. Contrary to what might seem obvious, Eli Zebra's name was not pronounced like that of the familiar black and white African horse. His last name was pronounced with a soft E, so it rhymed with Debra or Ephedra. Whenever people got his name wrong, and everybody got it wrong, Eli would say, "It's pronounced exactly how it looks," which only made them more confused. Eli Zebra was one of the few adolescent males in OWL who did not have a nickname, mostly because it's impossible to come up with a better nickname than Zebra, particularly when it's not pronounced Zebra. It was exotic by default. "That's true, Zebra," Laidlaw said, unimpressed. "I suppose the killing of a whale is technically what Moby Dick is about, although that's kind of like saying Where the Red Fern Grows is about the best way to feed a dog to a wolverine." "If whale hunting was truly the point of that book, nobody would care about the point. Do you understand what I'm saying, Eli? Moby Dick is about a lot of things. It's about vengeance. It's about making rope. And the reason I bring these things up is because all of these are all things you would normally learn about this semester. This is because normally we always read Moby Dick as part of junior English. But not this year. You people won't read Moby Dick until next year when I teach you senior English, even though senior English is supposed to be British literature and Herman Melville was an American. Does anyone know why we're doing this? Does anyone know why we're not going to read Moby Dick this year?" Here again, no one responded. However, this was not due to apathy. It was due to the fact that this was unknowable, even for Rebecca Gruba. "The reason we are not reading Moby Dick," Laidlaw continued, "is because I want us to read the novel we would normally read next year, as this particular novel is British. And we're going to read this book for a very specific reason. Does anyone here know anything about the writer George Orwell? Anything at all?" Again, Zebra responded without raising his hand. Now that he was 16 years old, raising his hand struck him as immature. "He was a homosexual alcoholic," Zebra said. "No," Laidlaw countered. "No, he was not. You're thinking of Truman Capote, who was American. And quite frankly, Zebra, those are pretty strange things for you to know about Truman Capote, even though both of those facts are true. But I can guarantee you that George Orwell was not gay. Let's be clear on this. George Orwell was not gay. More importantly, George Orwell hated communism. Granted, that detail can be confusing to some readers because Orwell didn't hate socialism. Now, I'm not even sure if any of you even know what those two terms mean, and even if you do, you're probably wondering what the difference is. Here's the simple answer. Right now, in Russia, they have communism. But socialism doesn't exist and probably never will. Do you see what I mean? It's complicated. The difference is subtle, yet vast. Mitch wondered what it would be like to have a girlfriend. What would they do together? What would they talk about? What did John Laidlaw talk about with Tina McAndrew? It was always so hard to come up with things to say. When you want to kiss someone, do you ask for their permission or do you just go for it? Mitch had kissed only one girl in his entire life. It was 13 months ago. She was a black-haired eighth grader who had moved to OWL only 2 weeks before. They were both drinking root beer schnapps. It was at a party at the Apple Grove, and drunkards were throwing apples at parked cars. This 14-year-old female stranger was much more romantically experienced than Mitch, and that made everything terrifying. He could recall the conversation directly preceding the physical exchange, but the words had seemed wholly unrelated to the kissing. She asked him about a rock group he was completely unfamiliar with, while he asked if she'd ever heard about some implausible movie called Fast Times at Ridgemont High. The black-haired girl ultimately made out with three different boys at this same party, and late in the evening, she casually pulled down her pants and peed in front of everyone. Her motives were ambiguous. Mitch was relieved when she moved away 2 months later. Orwell's greatest achievement was Animal Farm, droned Laidlaw, gaining both momentum and intensity. That book was about how unpopular ideas can often be silenced without the use of force. That's one of the core dangers of communism, and of all government, really. The story also involves brilliant diplomatic farm animals, which is why it's such a classic. However, we are going to read Orwell's second best book, which is called 1984. Can anyone here guess where we're going to read 1984? Because it's 1983, said Zebra. No, said Laidlaw. But at least you're within striking distance, Zebra. We are not going to read 1984 because it's 1983. We are going to read 1984 because it's going to be 1984. This is something that's going to happen, and it's going to happen to all of us. 4 months from now, when we finally reach New Year's Day, you are all going to see a lot of news stories about 1984 on the TV and in the newspapers, and everybody in the world is going to be talking about the significance of this book. And the situation is this. I want you all to understand what everyone is talking about. I want you to understand the references. When some bozo on TV says, "Hey, here we are in 1984, and it's nothing like that book by George Orwell," you will be able to say, "Really? Are you sure about that? Maybe you're wrong about that. How much freedom do we really have? Where are my taxes going?" This is something the whole country is going to be talking about when we attack January. That kind of dialogue is going to be everywhere. So, as always, I'm having the senior class read 1984, but I'm also having you juniors read 1984. And I'm also having the sophomores read it, and I'm having the freshmen read it. And I've told Mrs. Strickland that she should have her 7th and 8th grade English students read this book, and she has agreed to do so. So we're all in this together. Everyone in this school is going to read 1984. We will all have the same specific experience, and it's going to be wonderful. Mitch sketched a three-dimensional cube on his notebook and dreamt about the near future. In 3 months, it would be basketball season. Maybe this year he could wear a t-shirt underneath his jersey, not unlike Patrick Ewing. The central issue in 1984 is personal privacy, said Laidlaw. He saw this as the main issue in many novels. It's about governmental intrusion, which is a complex problem. For instance, I'm sure you're all very familiar with the Gordon Call incident that happened 6 months ago, just up the road from here. Gordon Call had a long-standing dispute with the federal government, and he didn't want to pay his income tax. He didn't want anyone to pay their taxes. Now, that impulse is completely understandable, but when federal marshals from Fargo tried to arrest him for non-payment, he shot two of them with a rifle. Gordon Call was an excellent shot. Can we defend Call's actions? Of course not. We certainly cannot support Gordon Call, or at least not his willingness to murder people. The citizens of Medina, North Dakota, will never recover from that tragedy. The community will never be the same. But such a situation raises many questions. What role should the government play in our lives? What is freedom, really? And at what point is freedom more important than respect for the rule of law? As you read 1984, you will learn about a man named Winston Smith. This is a man watched by the government and hounded by a group called the Thought Police. He is under surveillance 24 hours a day. This, obviously, would be horrifying. I'm sure none of you would enjoy being watched 24 hours a day. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of you would love being watched 24 hours a day. Watched. As opposed to washed? This is not an erotic thriller. Yeah, I think. Yeah. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of you would love being watched 24 hours a day. Laidlaw smiled and swiveled his skull around the room like an oscillating fan. His arms remained motionless. A few of the girls giggled. They knew what was coming. How about you, Vanna? Laidlaw finally said, fixing his robotic dragon eyes on the ever-slumping Mitch. Vanna... Vanna, are you not getting enough rest, Vanna? How would you feel if you were watched 24 hours a day? What would we see behind closed doors? Would it shock us? Would we be shocked? There is no viable answer to this kind of query. You would not be shocked, Mitch said. I'm not... shocking. Actually, I think I might be shocked, Laidlaw said. I think I would be shocked if I saw you awake, since I can only assume you sleep 15 hours a night. The other kids laughed, but not in a mean way. They laughed because someone in a position of authority had told the predictable joke, and it would have made things weirder if everyone had sat there in silence and tried to figure out why Mr. Laidlaw was obsessed with the possibility that Mitch Herlicka was narcoleptic. It was a joke Laidlaw had been making for three consecutive school years. Silence would have made the joke seem meaner than it was, so they laughed for the sake of normalcy. Minutes passed, or maybe decades. The bell rang. Each of the 22 juniors picked up a paperback copy of 1984 off the top of Laidlaw's desk and power walked toward their lockers. In 3 minutes, the 17 smartest juniors would go to chemistry, while the five dumbest would attend the alternative option, vocational technologies. Zebra walked with Mitch. Dude, said Zebra, because of Sean Penn saying dude had recently become fashionable. Dude, that dude hates you. Why the fuck does he hate you? I don't understand why that dude fucking hates you so much. He doesn't hate me, Mitch replied. He just knows I don't care what he says. As he said these words, Mitch imagined how wonderful it would feel to jam a screwdriver into Laidlaw's eye socket. He imagined pushing Laidlaw down a flight of metal stairs, possibly toward a bear. He wondered if there would ever be a situation in his life where it would be acceptable to punch John Laidlaw in the face, and he wondered if his fist could shatter another man's jaw. Yeah, well, fuck that dude, said Zebra. And actually, I must say that this book sounds potentially not terrible. It sounds a little like Escape from New York. Which reminds me, I got the greatest fucking tape last weekend. Have you ever heard of ZZ Top? Mitch had never heard of anybody. Mitch hated rock music, and he could not understand why everyone he knew talked about it constantly. Whenever he tried to listen to FM radio, it always sounded completely ridiculous. All the lyrics were nonsensical, and all the guitars were identical. These ZZ Top guys have insane Texas beards and a killer fucking car, and it's all super heavy, said Zebra. They sing about eating TV dinners. The guitars are heavy as shit. They're heavier than everything. It's like a really heavy Cars album. I never understand why you say that, Mitch said. What do you mean when you say heavy? Heavier than what? Sound is just air. Are you saying this band sounds like heavy air? Yeah, said Zebra. It's like listening to a lot of gravity. That's incredibly stupid, said Mitch. The two teens walked into chemistry. John Laidlaw sat behind the desk in his room, completely alone. He was free for 1 hour. The classroom door remained open, and he could feel the cigarettes in his shirt pocket, taunting him. He was thinking about Truman Capote, and about how his life was in shambles, and about the last time he fucked Tina McAndrew, which had been tremendous. Thank you. Okay, first of all, I gotta say right up front, all the places I've ever read, Denver has the best collection of interesting laughs. Is Ernie here? It's like. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Jules Pfeiffer, Gustavo Arellano, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 18th, 2008.